You are listening to Your Pod and Your Staff, the podcast of College Life Christian Fellowship at UC Davis. I am Peter Nittler, the college pastor of First Baptist Church in Davis, California. And our mission is to shape college-age people from all spiritual starting points into complete and equipped agents of King Jesus. And on this podcast, we have tried to have conversations that will form you, encourage you, maybe even make you laugh, and we have hoped that they would be a source of King Jesus guiding you through this time. And originally, this was a project that was meant to accompany College Life in Exile, to be the coronavirus quarter substitute for Tuesday Night Talks. And speaking of Tuesday Night Talks, there is one College Life talk that I heard as a student that has lived on in my memory perhaps more than any other. And it won't shock you that it was a talk given by the man you often hear on this podcast, Stanford Gibson. I still quote it, I still reference it, I still cherish it, and it quite literally changed the way I live. What was it about? Well, after so many Tuesday nights being about the college experience, this one was about what happens after the college experience. And in the particular Stanford fashion, it was well-researched, it was full of realism, full of care, and in many ways, it was the experience of listening to this talk that helped shape the whole emphasis of this ministry. You know, we are very clear that we want to do college ministry in a way that make these the best years of your life to date, but that you're set up for the next decade to be even better. And friends, we are in the last week of the College Life quarter. There are students who are taking this next step in just a few short days. Students we love, students we can't imagine this ministry without. And so for this last episode, we are going to bust open the vault and revisit some of those ideas that were so informative for me and helpful for so many. And this time, I get to add my thoughts, along with Stanford and Miriam, and I hope beyond hope that this content would be one last piece of the puzzle to help you seniors become complete and equipped, that it would set you up to thrive in this next season. But before we start the podcast, let me say this to anyone who's wondering. It is no secret that the killing of George Floyd and the subsequent protests have captured everyone's eyes, hearts, and imaginations. It almost feels weird to be talking about anything else. I see that. But I want to let you know this, that even though the podcast was originally meant to span a quarter, we're thinking we might just keep it going. And when we do, a conversation responding to the events of this last week will be the first topic of conversation. And there's one person that I want to have that conversation with, and I've asked him, and he said yes. But for now, do you ever wonder what life is like after college? I hope so. Enjoy the pod. Bum, 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 bum. Guys, it is week 10. Nostalgia week of College Life is here. People are graduating. People are ending their College Life careers. There's sadness. There's happiness. I'm with Miriam and I'm with Stanford.
Hello.
Hello, my friends.
Hello.
The day before we recorded this, there was a senior Sunday at FBC and we had our last 12 meeting with the 12 team for the year. So things are wrapping up. And by the time people listen to this, we will have had our last Tuesday night, the open mic night. So we are firmly in that season. And I realized yesterday when we were in our last 12 meeting, we were doing some affirmations and we were talking about the seniors. And I noticed myself getting choked up a few times. And I realized that I have like a tell, like a crying tell, you know, like in poker, it's like you do something with your face or you do something with your voice. That's like, it's like the same thing every time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I realized that it's like when I start to get choked up, I say the same thing every time. And so I was wondering if you guys had a thing that you do if and when you are about to cry. Do you have anything like that?
I don't know.
Miriam, I think that you might just get really quiet.
I do get really quiet right before I cry. That's true.
Yeah, I definitely try not to talk. I have a weird relationship with crying. Like, I was unable to cry for about 10 years. Like, I just never did it. And then later in life, after I had kids, now mediocre Super Bowl commercials will make me cry. I literally cried 3 times during the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, just a commercial. Like, it's a running joke in our family. Like, we're watching Avatar right now, and we'll get to like a sub climax in the middle of one of these cartoons, and I'll just start tearing up, and my kids will just laugh at me. So I think darkness. I try to turn off the lights so people can't see me cry.
Yeah, when I'm about to cry, it's like I'm talking, and then I feel that feeling in my nose, and then I smile, and then I say something like, okay.
I was impressed because you were able to keep talking as normal while you were crying. I think that's probably why I get quiet.
Right. The talking sucks.
Yeah.
So anyway, it is that time of year, and I'm aware of the uniqueness of this job, that it's really good, I think, to be in a position where you are forced to reflect every year. I kind of think about other jobs that the reflection that's done is like an annual report or something like that. That's very technical and results based. But we have this position that's really unique of people leave our lives every year, people that we've built relationships with. And I sometimes tell people that it's really hard. By the time people graduate, they're like friends, you know? So I'm in this position where my friends are always leaving me, and which sounds much more depressing coming out of my mouth than it felt in my mouth. Anyway, so we were struggling with what to do for this last episode, because at this time of year, I just want to be reflective. I want to be thinking about what was and celebrate the seniors, especially in a year like this, where anything you can do to fill their bucket of blessing with how strange this quarter's been has been something that I've really wanted to do. And so it feels like we should be doing something to remember the year, reflect on the year. But one of the things that we say a lot in college life is that we want to do college ministry in a way that is sort of like the best you've experienced up until this point. We want you to have a chance to make the best friends of your life. We just want this to be as fun as possible. But we want to do it also in a way that sets you up for the next decade to be better than this one. So we thought it would actually be appropriate to look at the next season for this last episode, to be thinking about, okay, what happens after college life? What happens to your last Tuesday night? What's next for you? Because we do care so much about what is on the horizon for our students. And you know, Stanford, you have a sort of legendary talk in the college life sphere. And I don't know if it's true, but I think the first time you gave it, I think I was a sophomore or a junior. And so I wasn't the year I was graduating, but it really put into perspective to me what was coming up. And, you know, I feel like amongst my cohort, there were lines and phrases from that talk that stuck themselves into our brains and became the way that we saw what happened after we graduated. And it was really, really valuable to us. And I feel like it was referenced a ton since then. And you know, sometimes we get in these positions, especially you and me, buddy, when we've been doing this for a while and we don't necessarily remember the last time we talked about this. We haven't talked about dating and relationships for almost 4 years now, but we've done it so many times that it feels like everyone's heard everything we've said. But the unique position of college ministry is that people are turning over so fast that they haven't heard it if it was 4 years ago. And same with this talk. I don't think people have heard it for quite some time, even though it feels like to us, or at least to me, that we talk about it all the time. People haven't heard this stuff that was in that particular talk.
Yeah, I think that one of the interesting things about college ministry is there's so much turnover, not only in the four-year cycle, but honestly from week to week and year to year with people going abroad and transfer students coming in, that it makes sense to cover some of the big topics on a 1, 2, 3 year cycle. Mm-hmm. But we're also very sensitive about, hey, if you've been coming faithfully for every Tuesday night for a year, we don't want to repeat a talk that you've heard. So, you know, it is a tension, but I think that there are three transitions in the church that people struggle with. The first one's obvious. It's high school to college, right? And you've all been through that and you've seen people go through that. And most of the people listening to this podcast, I think, have done it pretty well. But you've seen other people who are going to have a lot of regrets about how they did it. But the second transition, which is not given as much thought or reflection, is this transition basically from school life to whatever comes after. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, once you've kind of solidified your faith in college, you're going to transition into that phase pretty easily. And it turns out that that's actually not the case, that turns out to be a pretty traumatic transition and can feel like we're being downers about this. But I just think that knowing what to expect is really important. Knowing that a transition is difficult is important for a couple of reasons. One is, I think if you get there and you struggle with the transition, you struggle with it emotionally, you struggle with your habits, you might be tempted to think, I wonder if I'm bad at this. Everyone else is doing well, but this is going really poorly for me. Maybe I'm not a serious person of faith. And it's just helpful to know that, no, actually, this is a really hard transition. Everyone struggles with this, and it will get better. But then the other thing is, there are specific things you can do in this transition to minimize the pain and angst and also kind of move into the joy of the next phase more quickly. And so we just like to talk about some of that stuff.
Yeah, man, I totally, totally agree. And I have noticed the longer I've done this, I've become more and more obsessed about this transition. I notice how high my joy meter goes when I sense college life people a few years out still living for the king and being a part of a church and keeping close with their friends in college, but also gaining friendships where they're at. And just when they seem like they're doing well post-college, I've had this satisfying feeling of, oh, whatever role we played in that, we did our job. So I'm excited to talk about this. So here's what we're going to do. Here's the plan. We have sort of broken up the college to real life, quote unquote, transition into sort of three phases and three spheres. And we're going to talk about those sort of one by one. So we're going to talk about sort of the social transition, the vocational transition, and to be grammatically consistent, it would be the ecclesial transition. But we're not going to say that because that's pretentious. So we're going to say the social transition, the vocational transition, and life in the church transition. So that's what we're going to do because we think all these things are important. All these things make up big parts of our lives, and they all have certain sets of challenges and certain sets of things to be thinking about. And so we're starting in the sphere of the social transition. I remember, Stanford, when you gave this particular talk, I think what you did was you had reached out to people who had recently graduated and asked them kind of what their experience was like. Is that right?
That's right. We did a survey, basically. We reached out to both the recent class that had graduated, but also like people who had been out of college for one or two decades and asked them to reflect back on it. The first time we did this, it was probably 8 years ago now. You know, we'd been through a cycle of campus ministry and just occurred to us that what we should be doing is preparing people for what comes next. The college ministry isn't a kind of glorified youth group. It is a like part of your training for going into the next phase. And so the students who had recently graduated had really, really insightful thoughts. And there were a couple of themes. And one of the themes we found is that the one word that more students used than anything else was just the word loneliness. Feeling lonely and wishing you were still in college, a season of loneliness, extended loneliness. It seems like I was wandering into the future alone and defenseless. I began to feel lonely. And in the loneliness, sometimes it felt like you had fallen off the face of the earth. And then one student, Mariah, she kind of laid it out like this. She said, every person in our class, yes, even the ones who were engaged and married, had talked about feeling lonely post-college. I mean, even if you stay, everyone else leaves. I don't think I've ever been as lonely as I was in the 6 months immediately following senior year. Now, we did a series on loneliness this year, but in that transition, the loneliness is part of the central trauma.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? I feel like loneliness as a topic has begun to gain some steam. And so it makes more sense then as you hear it more, for you to attribute more of your experiences to it. If someone hears about loneliness more and more and more, they might attribute their current realities as loneliness, which is a good thing. But this, what you're talking about, this was like probably
8 to 10 years ago. Yeah.
So the fact that people are describing their experiences as loneliness then seems a little bit actually more remarkable because it wasn't quite in the cultural conversation as much. So the loneliness would have to register even higher for it to be attributed as loneliness. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it was before it was identified as a public health threat and all the stuff that we talked about this year, you know, before there was a federal commission on loneliness. And it was just this group of students that, you know, were just telling me how they felt in the 6 months after college. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Miriam, you are, fortunately and unfortunately for you, the closest person to this transition. Mm-hmm. And it's most probably salient to you. Stanford and I have been out of it for longer. And And so does this seem to hit home? Does this seem to fit with your experience at all or experience of your friends post-college, mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. loneliness story and maybe even reflecting on it just from the quotes you heard or from what we learned as we spoke on it this year?
Yeah, it definitely does. I think it wasn't something that was new to me. Loneliness was not a new experience for me after I graduated. And I was really fortunate because I graduated just over 2 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And when I was a senior, I decided that I was going to stay with my community and I was not going to move for a job, but was instead going to just hang out with my people and find work around my community, which wound up being, I think, one of the best decisions I've made in my life without having known how wise of a decision it would end up being.
Did you make that decision because of the community?
That was like probably 80% of the reason I decided to stay in Spokane.
That's interesting.
Yeah. A lot of my friends and housemates were a year younger than me. And so they were going to be around and in school still. And I think that helped me this year when I wound up leaving because I had already had some time to transition and to navigate not being a student. And it wasn't such an abrasive transition, but it's still really challenging. And a lot of my friends, in this past year, I think, have similarly felt, either because they just graduated this past year or because they were in a similar boat of like, it just sort of started hitting them later. It wasn't like that 6 month marker, but it was sort of as the effects of graduating started to wear on them more and more. A few of us started to realize the toll that being out of school had taken on our well-being. And it was a few months ago that I started realizing that I had been having like several conversations with some of my really good friends that were focused on like, I've recently realized I'm just not okay right now. And that was a comforting experience to realize that I wasn't alone in it. But, you know, in the loneliness series that we covered earlier this year, we talked a bit about the difference between social isolation and loneliness. Social isolation, we explained, was when you actually are separated from your community and you don't have a network of support and encouragement, et cetera. And then loneliness is a more subjective experience. You could actually have a strong community. You could be invested places. You could have that support and encouragement and still feel loneliness. And it feeds off of itself. You know, once you start to feel lonely, you start to perceive social interactions more negatively. That's you start to perceive threat more readily. And it makes you feel more alone, even if you're not. That sort of cycle is really important to break and requires a lot of awareness and active energy in fighting that state of being. If you can recognize, like, right now I'm feeling lonely, and that's probably changing the way that I'm perceiving people's interactions with me. And that means that I need to work even harder to get myself out of this rut. I think that's really helpful as we have this conversation. And just like, I'm not saying everyone is going to feel lonely after they graduate. I don't think any of us are saying that. But, you know, the chances are pretty high that you will at some point, if not now, then at some point in your life. But this is a time when you're more vulnerable to it. And if we can sort of set that expectation that, like, if that happens to you, like, you're not crazy and it's not you're probably going to feel that way at some points. But here are some ways that you can start to mediate those experiences. And I think that was helpful for me too, because I had some mentors in my life who prepared me for that. I think I mentioned in my loneliness talk this term PCD, post-college depression.
Yeah.
That you sort of graduate with this expectation that like life is set for you, or that could be one of the expectations that is communicated that like once you graduate, you'll just be on this trajectory towards success. That's not a guarantee. My expectations were already being managed. I think I would have been in a tougher spot if I hadn't had those voices in my life before I graduated.
Yeah. Have you guys, have you read, Oh, The Places You'll Go?
Yeah.
Yes.
By Dr. Seuss. That's currently on our like rotation of books that are out. That's one of the longer ones out there. And I'm always struck by this line when he says like, all alone, whether you like it or not, alone will be something you'll be quite a lot. And when you're alone, there's a very good chance you'll meet things that scare you right out of your pants. There are some down the road between hither and yon that can scare you so much that you won't want to go on. I feel like, I don't know, the idea of alone will be something you'll be quite a lot, sort of whether you like it or not. I think it's an idea that I resist on premise, but just feels like it's true. You know, it's like I find myself resisting like, no, you don't have to be alone. It doesn't have to be everyone's experience, but it does seem like it's enough people's experiences that it's good to be aware of, you know? And I think one thing I'm curious about is like, do we feel like the transition from college to after college is particular in its loneliness, or is it just because it's a transition and those are always marked by a certain level of social upheaval? And I mean, it just makes sense. You know, you're going from a place where you've been planted for at least a little bit in a pot of nutrients and soil. And I don't exactly know how to keep this metaphor going. I'm not a gardener by trade, but the, so is it just kind of transitions are hard and they come with them a certain sense of social upheaval, or is there something unique about this transition, do you think?
Well, I think it's both. I think that one is that the level of social connection at a residential university is artificially high. There's no other place in the world or in your life where you'll have that level of social connection. Yeah. The institution is built to create social connection. And so moving from that to any other, like even high level of social connection is going to feel like a loss. That's just part of stepping into life. That once you kind of establish the new way of building social connection in the actual vocational world, it's still going to feel like less, at least manic, than the college experience. But then you pair that with you're actually probably physically moving. You're going through relational transitions, vocational transitions. You're often going to a new city where you actually don't know anyone. That was my experience. I moved from New York to Madison, Wisconsin, and like literally didn't know anyone for my first 3 weeks there. I went on long bike rides, you know?
Yeah. And you're not married.
That's right.
If they're going to get married, they're usually not married yet. Often you are a single person moving to this brand new place.
And so your context radically changes. Plus, the skills that you've developed for making social connections are not the right skills for the new setting. And so in some ways, when you build the new skills for the new setting and develop the new connections in the new place, it's just good news. You will overcome at least the social isolation. Loneliness is a different thing, but that you will overcome it in a new way. You will find social connections in new ways once you develop those new skills in the new setting.
So, okay, wait, because I was thinking one thing that seems more positive about this transition is that especially, I feel like in college life, I like to think that we do relationships pretty well. And so there's a certain sense of like, I do feel like if you've kind of gone through 4 years here, you've probably experienced the necessary prerequisites for going into a new context and having the right skills. So what do you mean that the social skills you learn in college are not the same social skills you are needing in the next stage?
Well, when you're in college, there are a whole set of institutions that are setting up the framework for you to make social connections, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's your freshman dorm doing ice cream socials or college ministries doing student outreach or, you know, whatever, there are these institutions that are set up primarily for integrating new people into new communities because there's so much relational churn at the university that any institution that isn't actively, you know, welcoming new people just doesn't survive. But when you get into the world where there isn't that churn, institutions can do just fine not welcoming new people for decades. And so there isn't as much of a door into these new relationships. Lots of people feel like their lives are full, that they've got all the friends they need and don't necessarily need a new one. And so I feel like the skills it takes to build relationship after college are just way more intentional. Like you just have to take it upon yourself. You can't trust these institutions to automatically integrate you.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Stanford. I also think that college life and all of these other, you know, university institutions and groups and clubs and stuff, but college life is what I'm talking about now. Does a lot
a college
to
life podcast.
Yeah. Prepare students to learn skills for developing relationships that if they didn't have would make that transition into, you know, other working spaces where active hospitality is not a primary value way, way easier. Because if you don't have skills in conversation, if you aren't able to ask good questions, if you aren't able to put yourself out there a little bit, then like you're just going to get lost, you know, or it will be much easier for you to get lost.
And I think that's exactly right. And I think part of that is because you two are thinking a lot about really just preparing for this transition. And it really gets to how, you know, the transition went for me is that, you know, when we lived in three cities within 4 years of graduating undergrad. And so that means that, you know, we were dropped into these new urban centers, knowing no one again and again. And it turns out that we have like really close, deep relationships in each of those places. And that didn't have to happen. And it actually probably wouldn't have happened if it was just up to me. My wife, Amanda, was particularly good at this. And she realized early on that these institutions didn't have good mechanisms for integrating people in their early 20s. One of the things about churches is that, you know, churches are wonderful. I love churches, but churches really tend to focus on the people who give and, you know, honestly, people in the building life stage, people who have children, people in their 30s and their 40s. And they don't have often don't have a great paradigm for integrating people in their 20s. And so Amanda realized that earlier than most. Once we decided on a new church in a new town, she would do this. And you have to understand, my wife is an introvert, as am I. And so like, this is not something I would have done. It's not something that came naturally to her. But once church ended, again, in every city, every week, she would run around the sanctuary and like literally run to everyone who looked like they were in our demographic, who wasn't like harried with kids hanging off their arms, who looked lonely, and would invite them out to lunch. By the time we left each of these places, we had these gatherings of a dozen or more people who were going to lunch every week. And we formed these communities mainly amazing. Because she made them happen. And I think that's the primary takeaway here is that the infrastructure for forming these relationships isn't automatically there. It's kind of on you to create these sub-communities.
What's really cool about that story is that even as you had said, the skills are different. And I was like, hold on. I feel like we do so much to prepare people for the skills to do exactly what you're saying, but I'm aware that I am extroverted. And so that's maybe an easier sell to me. And so someone who's introverted might just be devastated to hear, I'm going to go to a brand new environment and really hold the weight of these social relationships. And it's kind of, it is on me on some level. There's not something opening the door wide open for me to have these relationships. And so it's cool to hear that that can still happen with some pretty intentional effort, though, from, I guess, a more introverted person. So that's a really great story to kind of have in our minds, I think, of that this might be kind of the thing it takes. I remember, so Jonathan Summer just graduated. So last quarter was in the winter, and he was going to do cross country his freshman year. And so he was here during the summer. So he was like this brand new student in the summer. And he was for a while there, silent as the grave. I mean, just doing very little talking. And I remember him and I went to Dumpling House, and I like to think that I can do a pretty good job guiding and pulling conversation along. And that particular lunch with him, when he was like fresh out of a really, really great high school experience where he really loves his family, close to his family, really great friends. And now he's in this town with no other freshman there. And so he's already sort of set up to be a little bit discouraged by the beginning of the college experience. And then he gets here and there's no one here. You know, he's with, you know, a few of the athletes. I think that transition was really hard for him. And I remember him saying, he's like, I just don't think I'll ever have the friendships that I had in high school. And what was really interesting is him and I were at, by the way, I just needed to ask about Star Trek, apparently, and it got him talking. That was the thing that got him rolling.
Or film production. I love talking to Jonathan about film production.
Totally, yeah. I hadn't discovered that yet. So Star Trek was that conversation. It was like, oh, okay, he's down to talk about this. But we got lunch together right before we graduated, and I was sort of asking him some reflective questions on how his time was here. And he was like, you know, what's weird is that when I got here, I remember telling you that I didn't want to leave my high school friends. And now I'm in this experience where now it's like, I don't want to leave my college friends. I feel like the worries that I had going in that I wouldn't be able to make the friends that I had in high school and stuff like that, those proved to be unfounded. Like I made the thing that we say, like made the best friends of my life during my time here. And I don't know, it's an encouraging story to me. And I do think that college is set up to create those environments, but it is still true that with each transition, it probably feels like it's not going to get better than this. Mm-hmm. And I make no promises that it'll be better or it will always exceed your college experience, but the beginning stages are not necessarily indicative of how it's going to go on. I remember at the end of every birthday that I would have when I was younger, I would cry and I would say, there's never going to be a better birthday than this one.
That's so precious.
Never going to be a better one. This is the number one possible birthday. So anyway, I think transitions and change are hard for me in general.
A student that came through a number of years ago, Adam Darbone, is just like the most gregarious, extroverted person that you could meet, you know, someone you would imagine would have no trouble with this transition.
Yeah.
He said that one of the things he realized early in his post-college years is that he was comparing his friendships the first year out of college to his friendships the last year of college and finding them wanting. When he realized that he wasn't remembering the loneliness of freshman year and that he should be comparing his first year out of college relationships with his freshman year relationships, which were kind of underwhelming. And the issue is that you will still feel that way 4 years out of college unless you invest in those freshman relationships, right? Unless you build those relationships that are feeling underwhelming compared to your 4-3 year relationships, you have to start and invest in those in order to be in the place 4 years out of college that you were in your fourth year of college.
That makes sense. So even though some of this might feel like bad news, you know, the fact that, yeah, you are entering a season that could be marked by loneliness, social isolation, and all of the unsettling feelings that come with that. Not necessarily the good news, but I guess the perspective is that you experienced this before and sort of look where you are now.
That's right.
Justin Morton and I, we were hanging out before he left, and he was talking to me about the curse of knowledge and this idea that once you know something, you forget what it was like to not know it.
That's right.
And it feels a little bit probably like that. It's like we have the curse of these social relationships where it's like now it just feels like this is normal life to have these social relationships and these satisfying ones. And you forget what it was like to go through the process of building them.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it's like revisiting your notes from a class in high school or something like that, where it's like, oh, yeah, I remember learning this. I'm relearning again what it means to build relationships. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. I've been there before. You just have probably maybe a little bit of the curse of knowledge of you forget what it was like to not know it.
Sure.
And to not be in that scenario, you know. Yeah. Do we have any other good news? Do we have any other tips? Any other like, hey, this might make it more helpful?
I would say be a person who says yes. If it's not immoral, illegal, or life-threatening, say yes and be a person who is unsatisfied with digital relationships. Mm-hmm. Say yes to things in the real world and resist the temptation to substitute real world embodied relationship building with digital substitutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a really good point, Stanford. And also a little bit tricky if you are somebody who moves away or if most of your friends from school move away, because I have found there is a little bit of a balance to be found in maintaining those best friends of your life that you made in college with forming new relationships. You know, I get caught in like, I want to spend time catching up with my old friends because I don't want these friendships to die. I want them to continue to be sustained for many, many years. And those relationships are going to have to change in order to look differently to accommodate our new lives and social circles. And that's okay. But there also needs to be space to say yes to your new community and to put in the immense amount of effort it will take at the beginning to sort of get momentum going with a new community, because it's going to be a lot of input that's going to feel really draining when you're already feeling not supported, potentially. This is potentially.
Yeah.
Before you get to see some of the like momentum build and the reciprocity in the relationships start to be really like rich and deep. But you need to have the time and the capacity to invest in those spaces. So I don't know. I just think it's interesting because I just moved, you know, in September. And so a lot of my rich and deep friendships right now are friendships that I'm engaging in digitally or like over the phone, and have been, you know, a godsend for me and continue to be very nourishing and encouraging and supportive for me. But I've needed to sort of push myself to not rely wholly on those and to go out into the deep end a little bit and be willing to be uncomfortable and embrace a new community because I know it's worth it.
Yeah. I'm having an insight right now.
What you got?
This is a live insight and also could be wrong. But the beauty of the podcast, again, like I've said, is I feel like you can be wrong. You can just work with your ideas. But Stanford, sometimes what you talk about is like the difference between high frequency, low impact, or low frequency, high impact, those differences.
That's right. The difference between daily devotions and a retreat. You want a mix of these high frequency, low impact, low frequency, high impact.
Yeah. So here's my insight. I wonder if the friendships that you've built in college, if you think of them as like a bank account, you know, it's like part of the investing that you've been doing over the years is that now those relationships can handle a transition into lower frequency, higher impact type behavior. Mm-hmm. So it's like,
this is good.
You actually don't need to talk every week to these friends, you know, what you maybe need to do is go pick a weekend every single year that your friends are going to go away and have this sort of retreat type thing together. You know, you're going to make sure Memorial Day weekend every year we're going away. And then, people are going to get married and have kids. And it's going to get complicated. But for these next couple years, we're going to do this and we're going to maintain these connections. And that weekend, plus maybe some other conversations and questions and text message conversation and stuff, that will be enough to keep this going. But where you go next, we'll need high frequency, low impact attitudes and strategies where it's like, I'm going to spend time with people and it's not going to feel great every time.
Yep.
And I'm going to be doing all sorts of different things that maybe I'm not even that interested in doing, but I'm trusting that it's more about quantity of time with the new friendships than quality time.
Yep.
Like it's just get me some reps with these people.
That's right.
Which sounds like I'm saying just grit it out. But what I'm trying to say is that these things, these new relationships and the old relationships require different types of investments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if that's a potentially good metric to think about is like these friends that I've had in college, we can survive on lower frequency, but maybe higher impact type communication and type friendship. But the place I'm going is going to need a lot of my yeses.
That seems to make sense to me.
Yeah. The high frequency matters, but it also matters because you're going to have to kiss some frogs. You know, there's going to, you can have community with anyone who is a person of faith because you're family. But finding friends, you know, there's a certain like personality match that has to happen there.
Yeah.
And so you need to actually like be in large gatherings of people just so that you can meet people that you're going to connect with.
Mm-hmm. So unless there's any more good news tips kind of thing of here's how to handle this season that might be difficult, it might be smart to move on to the vocational sphere of this conversation. Anything else on the social sphere before we leave it? Feels like we're in the Disneyland lands, you know, before we leave social
land. Let's go to New Orleans land.
I think that just one more thing to say on that is that we've had sort of this prepare for the worst bent to our conversation, which is important. And also like, it's so exciting because, you know, wherever you find yourself, wherever you end up, whatever community you land in, there's going to be more people that you get to encounter and be influenced by, and might take more work to develop those relationships. And it might be exhausting and draining and lonely at times. But also, I remember the joy of my freshman year of college, of coming back to my room after having hung out with new people or formed a new connection, feeling so elated that there are like these new people in my life, and my world was expanding as I got to embrace another corner of the globe. And that is something I would be sad if we didn't communicate today, that while this might be scary, it's also going to be a huge gift wherever you end up, and you will be embraced by new people who will love and support you. And you'll have the chance to love and support new people. And that is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say another thing of good news, too, is that the post-college relationship portfolio is just kind of richer and more diverse. You know, there's a lot of talk about diversity on a college campus, but it's really like, honestly, there are very few places in the world that are less diverse. It's everyone is in exactly the same life stage, you know, very similar socioeconomic background largely. We moved from undergrad to, you know, a church in downtown Buffalo that was ethnically diverse. In our demographic, there were people who were getting their PhDs and people who, you know, had not gone to college and were, you know, stepping into a vocation. And there were people who were just starting to, you know, get married and have children. There are people who've been single for a decade. It was like legitimately a diverse experience that was, yeah, you know, kind of much, much more human and life-giving. I just think, yeah, if you can embrace that instead of be like, wow, there are not that many people that are just like me, I think that you'll actually grow more.
Yeah. I'm even realizing sort of a mental tone that I have for this conversation that we're having is that I actually feel pretty confident in not just this class, but I do in this particular class, yeah, in right, general or specifically, but I do feel confident in the people in college I've going on to the next step and eventually having some level of thriving. Mm-hmm. I think that part of thriving and flourishing more quickly is to know what to expect on some level, to know what might be a normal experience is to have a certain level of social upheaval, that might be normative for just all people, but that to remind these people specifically that you have actually the tools and you have practice doing that which is absolutely necessary to make this thrive. And not even just necessarily for you to like join a community, but even if it comes to the point like just like Stanford was saying with his wife Amanda, that if you even need to build a community, that mm-hmm, it's very similar skills and tools that I think you've just by being in college life and having gone through this experience together that you have in your tool belt. I have a lot of confidence mm-hmm in this transition and the joy that it can be. But a lot of times joy is found through struggle and flourishing is found at the other side of something that was hard. And so if it feels hard, that's okay. Doesn't mean you're doing it wrong.
Right.
I really appreciate what you said, Miriam, because I think that it matches what I feel a lot too, is that there's so much excitement for what comes next for yeah, these students. Yeah. Yeah. And there's also some things that might feel like speed bumps. Right. And that's really what I feel like they are, speed bumps on the way to bigger, better things, which sounds cliche, man. Anyway, if we are in the Disneyland lands, we can leave social land and move into vocational land. So this season is not just one of transitioning from, you know, one community to another community, but often a vocational transition mm-hmm as well. And so what insight, what wisdom, what expectations can we give our people for the vocational transition?
Real quick, I just noticed after I graduated that it was super uncomfortable to not be a student. And I would imagine that might be a sentiment that some of our students feel after they graduate. But I was looking for work after I graduated and I was not trying to find a career position. I was a nanny for a year and it was a really wonderful experience. That was not something I was planning on doing forever. But I just remember feeling like very jealous of my friends who were still in school. And yeah, I didn't think I would feel that way because I was so excited and ready to graduate. But I realized like I've been doing this my whole life. Of course, I'm going to feel like part of my identity has been taken from me because I've known how to be Miriam the student since I was, you know, in preschool. And now all of a sudden it's like, what do I do with my time?
I think that that's really important idea because I think there are two structures in the university system that really set the pace of your life. And when you were in it, you kind of hated it, but you don't realize how much that you depended on them for who you were. And I think that that's the quarter system and the GPA. You know, the quarter system is a tyrant, right? But like, I think that almost everyone who got their first job after college, who I've talked to about this, said that the experience of week 11 at a job is just devastating because you're like, hold on, wait, what? This keeps going? Like, when does this stop? When do I just take my B and then start start over, you know, like, and so the quarter system where things get refreshed and you get a series of short term and medium term goals where you get immediate feedback on how you did is part of how we ordered our lives. And the loss of that is actually something that people mourn, and they don't know they're mourning it. They're being thrust into this realm where they're setting, like, you have an evaluation with your supervisor every year, and you talk about, like, your 6 month, your year, your 10 year goals. And we're just not used to thinking on those scales. And so it seems like the quarter system was a tyrant, but it was a tyrant that we grew to appreciate and need. And the other is the GPA. The GPA, many people also see as a tyrant. Like, we've been living our whole lives for this stupid number, and we're just glad to be free of it. Mm-hmm. But we don't realize that essentially we've been living life like a video game with this series of, like, short-term quests that we get immediate numerical feedback on, and just don't get that kind of numerical feedback, which either tells you, oh, I need to fix this now, or it's just real affirmation that, hey, I'm on the right track, I'm doing well. And your supervisor in almost any job won't give you a numerical score. You're lucky if you get mentoring. And so learning to live life with intrinsic motivation and long-term goals is part of this transition.
Mm-hmm. What are those rooms called? The completely soundproof rooms?
Oh, like the sensory deprivation rooms?
Yeah, I think it was like a boss of mine telling me about them a few years ago, and it just always stuck with me because he was talking about how people go like crazy. It is so unnerving being in a soundproof room because there's no feedback. Like, you're not getting any feedback from your surroundings, kind of giving you a sense of where you're at and making you know, like, where you're settled in your environment. And I wonder if that's, like, a helpful analogy at all for kind of what it's like to not be in a university setting where you're not getting feedback from your professors constantly, from your GPA, from your peers even telling you, like, yeah, you're on the right track, this is kind of where you are, and this is how you course correct. You're sort of, like, you know, set in this workplace environment and asked to do something, and all of your sensory input seems to be taken from you. You have to search for, like, am I in the right spot here? Am I going the right way? How do I know? Like, someone help me out here.
Well, Stanford, I remember when you gave this talk, I remember there being, like, a book that you drew on, and I remember you saying something like, this is, like, the source, like, this is the thing.
Yeah, so when I give this talk, I recommend two books, which is always weird because you're, like, graduating college and I'm giving you an assignment, and that just seems, like, tone deaf, right? But I feel like there's two things that you need to understand, and one is the theology of this transition, and the other is the psychology of this transition. And so the first thing you need is, like, a theology of work. And I have two or three talks about theology of work. The idea is that you need to come up with a reason why you are going to give the best hours and the best years of your life to these things then that early on might seem pretty underwhelming. And, you know, the church has reflected on vocation, you know, since its inception. Like, it's right there in the Genesis story. But Tim Keller has a book called Every Good Endeavor, which is a pretty accessible theology of work that, as you find yourself kind of wrestling with the early stages of vocation, could really help you reflect well on the purposefulness of making photocopies for a supervisor who doesn't seem to know you exist. But the other book, this is the book I give to graduating seniors that I know well. It's called The Defining Decade by Meg Jay. Meg Jay is a psychologist. It's not written from her perspective of faith. I don't know anything about her faith background. She was a psychologist at Berkeley and then developed a practice entirely devoted to helping people in their early to mid-20s because she realized that this is a traumatic period, a period of growth, a period of potential that no one's actually providing guidance on how to work through. And so she wrote this book, The Defining Decade. I read almost the whole book on a plane to Japan. Like, it's that compelling. I couldn't put it down because I saw the story of our graduating students in it. And she has a TED Talk. I recommend go and listen to the TED Talk. Meg Jay is her name. Mm-hmm. Usually, if someone does a TED Talk, you don't have to read the book because most books are just blown up pamphlets. That is not the case.
Okay, wait. I say that line. Did I get that from you?
You might have. It might just be so true that we both realized.
No. I think congratulations. You made it into my subconscious without being quoted. So good job. Yeah.
But this book needs to exist. This is a book that you should read coming out of college. It covers romance, it covers lots of different things, but it really covers this issue of vocation. And she says that the 20s, this time right out of college, is a time of like identity flux. And the reason it's a time of identity flux is because you've lost those feedback mechanisms that tell you you're valuable from college. By the time you've been in college for 4 years, you've learned how to play the game. You can go in and bang out a class. And you're getting this affirmation from your GPA, and now you're out in the world. And there is this kind of identity crisis, and people talk about needing to find themselves in their 20s. And one of the things that Dr. Che says is she says, that's not really the right metaphor. You can't find yourself in your 20s because, you know, and I don't mean to be harsh here, but you're 20. There's not much to find, right?
Yeah.
Like she says, the best way to develop a sense of self and a sense of identity is to become something, is to really invest in a few things that will help you build your identity. And a lot of that will be vocational skill. You know, for her, it was actually not jumping right into her job, but working Outward Bound for a while that gave her some real like soft skills, but also gave her a sense of accomplishment. And her basic idea is that identity isn't something that comes from within that you have to find. It's something that you generate evidence of who you are by taking on these tasks and building the skills so that you have external evidence that you are becoming something.
Huh. So the difference is you're not finding something that's already there, but you're actually still in the process of forming something real.
That's right. And you're not going to automatically know what that is. Because let me read you a portion of what she says. She says, contrary to what we see and hear, reaching your potential isn't something that usually happens in your 20s. It happens in your 30s and your 40s and your 50s. And so she goes on to say that people talk about the 20s as a throwaway decade, as a decade where, well, you know, you're not really going to arrives. So it doesn't really matter what you do. You know, the 40s are the new 30s. So the 20s, you can kind of do whatever you want with. But she makes the case that the reason that people reach their potential in their 30s and their 40s is because they invest their 20s. There's a bench you have to build in order to get there. And so she says that we do know how the 20s work, and 20 somethings everywhere deserve to know it too. Common wisdom about 20 something years is often wrong. Who I am is a question best answered not with a protracted identity crisis, but with one or two good pieces of something we call identity capital. And what she means by identity capital are things that you've accomplished, skills that you've developed that you can build on to do the next thing, that you can build on to do the next thing until all of a sudden you're actually doing the things you want. But that all of a sudden is really a decade later. And you need to spend this decade building that bench.
Okay. So just to try to think really clearly, can you peel back your story and see what were those things in your 20s that were identity capital builders?
Well, I've done this survey several times with ex-students. You know, one of the questions I ask in the survey is, what is the most useful advice you would give to graduating seniors? And one of our friends, Jeff Tan, who he holds the record for number of times attending a College Life Tuesday night because he ran the soundboard for years after he was there, just an institution. And he had a one-liner. He said, become proficient at Microsoft Excel. And like, that just sounds underwhelming.
Yeah.
That's a long way from change the world, you know, the places you could go, become proficient in a database software. But the idea is that you need these pieces of identity capital. You need to develop these skills in order to be trusted with the next task. So I think that it's a combination of, first, realizing that your first few jobs are not going to be the career that you hope for, that you're going to have to build some trust, build some capital, and then just take every possible opportunity to develop a new skill. Even if over the summer, while you're looking for work, you know, get on edX. They've got free MATLAB and R classes. I'm sure they have classes for things that aren't engineering that I don't even have the categories for. You know, like I just got done looking at a bunch of student resumes for some summer hires. And I can tell you that if any one of them had said, oh yeah, after college, I went on to edX and I took this free R class, I would hire them immediately because it shows that they're building identity capital, that they're moving towards a goal, that they realize that they don't have the skills yet that they need, and they're starting to acquire them.
Why is identity capital not just called skills? Like, is it distinct from skills at all?
Because it is experiences that build confidence. And so skills build confidence, particularly for nerds and introverts. That's how we build confidence, is we just acquire skills and then sell them. But for someone, like people who are more social. Like, for example, Meg J, her identity capital was to work at Outward Bound. And this is an experience that was difficult and it was challenging and it was social and it helped her believe that she could do hard things. And then when she went to grad school at Berkeley, she had this experience on her resume that says, hey, I'm a person who can do hard things. And so it's not just a skill. You're building your story both to yourself and to other people who might give you opportunities.
I don't mean to keep poking. I'm trying to figure out in terms of what these things could be. Are they basically just any opportunity, like anything to say yes to, or ought to be a little more targeted?
I mean, I feel like it would be nice if it's targeted, but the reality is, like, so often you don't actually know what you're trying to learn. Maybe that's not true for a lot of people, and I am projecting my own confusion onto everyone else. But, like, for instance, after I graduated, my friend who was leading a youth group asked me to come and speak at his high school winter camp. And at that point, I wasn't really interested or pursuing, like, working in the church. So I said no. And he was like, I think you should really reconsider. And so I reconsidered and I said yes. And it was the catalyst for me pursuing this job. And I would have had no idea that that would have launched me into something else, but it did a lot to develop my skill and my confidence and gave me like an excitement for this sort of work. And I didn't realize that it was targeted. Maybe that's kind of what it was. It's like it wound up being, it's like a targeted identity capital investment, but I didn't realize it at the time.
So there is a ecological economic model that you can apply to the exact question we're asking. The question we're asking is, you know, how much time do we spend investing in opportunities that don't seem particularly targeted towards what we hope to do? And how much time and effort do we invest in a particular path that moves us forward in a particular direction? And the model is called explore exploit. How much time do you spend exploring and how much time do you spend exploiting? And obviously it's alliterated. And so that's why like exploit is such a terrible word. And so I would say explore invest. You should spend a certain amount of time exploring things, saying yes to things that seem kind of maybe adjacent to your path or that help you try things out. If you're kind of doing this right, you're going to try some things that return the null hypothesis that say, yeah, this isn't for me. We're not doing this. But then as you find the like cluster of things that seem to be coalescing into things that you are talented at, things that you enjoy, things that help build your sense of purpose, then you start to spend less of your time exploring and more of your time investing. And, you know, I'm at the point in my life where I still am in this explore invest stage, but I do a lot more investing on a particular path and less exploring. And, you know, in your early 20s, you're all the way on the explore side of that thing. You're trying to figure out what is the vocational landscape and how do I fit into it? And you say yes to challenging opportunities and learn from them and then either double down and invest in that or continue to explore. But if you take the safe position, if you pursue opportunities that you feel like, oh, that's easy, I can do that, particularly like continuing with, you know, a retail position or something like that, then you're giving up opportunities to explore that would eventually become opportunities to invest. And so the idea here is to do the scarier thing. And especially while you're underemployed, take the opportunity to build skills that would help people trust you to give you more challenging opportunities.
I think that I'm getting it in terms of what we're actually saying. Because I kept thinking like, well, what's the alternative to doing what we're saying? The alternative seems like doing nothing. Because it seems like everything could give you some experience or give you some benefit. But I think what we're saying is in the choice between, I can do this, this will be easy, no problem, versus this might be a little bit of a challenge and it would be a little bit more of a risk. We're actually saying consider doing the riskier thing because it will not only give you the skill of whatever that job is, but even perhaps train you and teach you that you actually can do more than you thought. And then also, if you are doing things that are perhaps simpler, then using that time to think outside of your current employment and think, what skills can I add? What things can I do to build into my view of myself that I can do things? Is that right?
That's right. And I think there are two versions of this. There are people who are more risk averse and people who are less risk averse. That's just personality trait. But this is a time to either build or venture. It's a time to think about, well, I want to be an engineer with a salary that can support my family and a house in California in my mid-30s. Buying a house in California basically means that you either inherited a lot of money or have found a way to make some serious money. And so, you know, what's it going to take to get there? It's going to start now. You either want to be like intentionally building your future, or there's a less risk-averse side of this. Do you have a dream? Do you have a dream of being an artist? Do you have a dream of, you know, starting a podcast? Do you have a dream of doing something that is really unlikely to happen? But if it's going to happen, it's going to happen because you give it 60 hours a week right now when other people don't depend on you. This is the time to venture. Yeah. And so it's either a time to build or venture. What it's not a time to do is the path of lowest resistance.
You mentioned Tim Keller's book about the theology of work. And one thing that I am hearing a lot from students and always feel like either I'm not as sophisticated enough a thinker about it, but it feels like to me an understanding of what a Christian ought to do in the workplace is like use their job to like glorify God. It's like sort of a general premise. But I feel like I am not the brightest. Like, I feel like I can imagine like five jobs. Like, I can imagine a pastor, a lawyer, a doctor, an engineer, and a teacher, and like a business person. You know, like those are the jobs that exist. And so it's like, okay, of those, well, it seems like a pastor and a doctor certainly do a lot of good kingdom work. But I hear in students sometimes really trying to work hard to find like the one-to-one ratio of how their job serves the kingdom. Does it directly help people in need? That's the only thing that working for the kingdom means. And so is there anything that we could just discuss now that would help with that question of how do I imagine my work as kingdom work? Is it only the work that has direct impact on helping a hurting person that is kingdom work? But what about, yeah, like you said, like making copies for someone? How can you possibly imagine that as working for the kingdom? Or if you're a higher up person in a position of like your engineering firm makes doors, you know, it's like, how is making doors contributing to the kingdom? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is the fundamental question that you need to get a hold of in order to find joy in the 80,000 hours that you're going to spend at your vocation. So again, this is one of my favorite topics, and maybe we can do a whole episode on it. Let me give you my two fundamental theological ideas. The first one is that I'm going to use a fancy theological term here, but it's going to become obvious what I mean, is that work is what we call a pre-fall ordinance. So what does that mean? Right. Well, the other pre-fall ordinance is marriage. And so what we see is that in Genesis, marriage is part of God's created order. When things were good in the garden before sin and death and came in, Adam and Eve were married. Romance is part of God's plan for human flourishing. And the fall didn't create marriage. It made it hard, but it was before the fall. And so it's part of God's plan for human flourishing is that we would be in families.
Yeah.
So how does work come in there? Well, it turns out that when God put this couple in the garden, they had a job. He gave them a task. They were supposed to tend this garden. And also one of my favorite details is that he also gave them the job of biological taxonomy. You know, they were also supposed to come up with mental categories for all the metazoa, which I just think is fantastic. But they were supposed to actually work with their hands and bring order out of chaos. Fall makes work toilsome is the word that the scripture uses. It makes it hard, marriage. But part of God's plan for human flourishing is that we would make things, that we would be at the act of creation, that we would become co-creators with God, including doors, which is the second big idea that I have, is that, so what skills are in play, right? Probably you shouldn't become a pimp, right?
I'm going to say absolutely.
Okay, all right, good. We have a pastoral proclamation. But what about like a day trader? Or what about working at a company that makes doors? These are pretty interesting ideas. And so like, what's your criteria? What's my criteria for when I get into work in the morning? Do I feel like I am fulfilling the creative mandate is what we call it. I'm acting in the way that God created me. Why shouldn't I quit my job and become a doctor or a pastor tomorrow? And that is because the creative mandate, what God asked that first couple to do, what God asks all of us to do in being co-creators with the creator is to bring order out of chaos. And so all work that brings order out of chaos is kingdom work. It is what we were created to do. And so doors bring order out of chaos. You know, they say fences make good neighbors. Doors make good families, right? The idea that you have a wall that is, you know, occasionally not a wall, there is no more ordering thing in the world. And so as you think about, is this task, is data entry bringing order out of chaos? You know, absolutely. You know, there is this whole world of observations that we can't understand until they are brought into something that you can metabolize in R. And so the more you start to think about the range of tasks that are available to you, the range of careers that are available to you, and do they bring order out of chaos? Now you have a more diagnostic tool to say, is this the path I want to be on? And did I spend my day well?
That's so interesting. And I feel like we're actually in at an advantage to recognize that more right now, because we're having everybody labeled as like essential or non-essential workers. We're seeing the breakdown of like what would happen if there weren't garbage people who took care of our trash. And like in our neighborhood, we had mornings where everyone would come out on the balcony and like cheer for, you know, the people who would come and clear the dumpster, because we were so grateful that like if they did not exist, then life would start to break down and we would be going back to a place of chaos. And so I just think now is an interesting time to be having that conversation, because I think our definition of what is a worthy pursuit with our life as a Christian has become a lot more expanded, or at least mine has, as I've been realizing that like we are all trying to make this society happen in a way that is beautiful. And just having a similar reflection on that like a month ago or something, as I was just feeling some of this pressure of like I need to change the world, and I'm feeling like I'm failing because I can't. And there just was this relief that came over me as I was sitting on my balcony, kind of having this, I really do think it was like a moment when like the Lord was speaking to me, like, calm down, just do what is in front of you faithfully and trust that you are participating in my kingdom work, and together we are all creating something beautiful.
I think that's a great insight. And one of the things that gets crosswired is I think that people confuse meaning for status. You know, when you think about what your job is and what you want your vacation to be, the fundamental question isn't, does this bring order out of chaos? The fundamental question is, how do I feel when I talk about this at a cocktail party, right? Yeah. Like, you know, sediment transport engineer, like some of you know, I have a 1 minute rule. I won't talk about my job at a party for more than 1 minute, because there's no way that anyone can be interested in it besides me for more than 1 minute. There are higher status things, but the fundamental question is, are you actually bringing order out of chaos? And if you are, then you are participating in the creative mandate, and it is something that you train yourself to feel joy about.
What's interesting though is like people's bosses are often not bossing them through the creative mandate and
mentoring them.
Yeah. Sure, that seems like that's the ideal, but is that how the world works? But it's like, if you were to go to some software company in the Silicon Valley, it seems like the pejorative way to think about a lot of that from my vantage point is like, it's make a lot of money really quickly. That's the goal of a lot of those companies, you know? So does this work in the world? Like, is this like an idealistic way to see your work? Can you do this kind of work even in a company whose main values and ethics are not neatly and tightly aligned with it?
I mean, this is going to be pretty personal. There was a time when I think I could have worked at Twitter or Facebook and had a narrative that I was bringing order out of chaos by increasing social connection, right? And like, I've used social media to maintain connected to the people in my various life stages and have just been enriched so much by that. But I think I would have a hard time right now working for one of those companies and believing I was bringing order out of chaos and not the opposite.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty personal. And that's the sort of thing that you could work through with mentors. When I went to graduate school, they had vocational pods. It was people in the humanities would get together and the people in STEM would get together. And they would talk about how their work was fulfilling the creative mandate, or maybe how it wasn't and how it could. And so I do think that this is the sort of question that grown-up people ask at Bible studies, right? Like, how is your job fulfilling the creative mandate? How could your work habits bring order out of chaos? Or, man, I think I need to think about a career switch because I think that I'm creating chaos out of order.
Yeah, I feel like I have 1,000 more questions of just how to fine-tune this. Because I think sometimes when I hear like the order out of chaos thing, what I hear is an implicit like, dude, way more than you think is within like the kingdom bounds. But then sometimes I hear that statement as like everything can be within the kingdom bounds if you just do some mental gymnastics. But it actually seems like what we're saying is something in the middle of those two things, where it's like, no, there might be some things that don't seem necessarily illicit that might not be the best place to aim your life.
This reminds me of the N.T. Wright stuff that we talked about at the beginning of the year that I just fell in love with and want any excuse to talk about, where he uses this analogy of scripture being like a 5-part play, where the first four parts of it have already been written, and that's what we see in the Word of God. And part five was started, but it wasn't finished. And it's like, yeah. What would happen if you found an incomplete Shakespeare play and you asked people to perform it? They would have to know the story really, really well in order to improvise the rest of the story in a way that is consistent with how you imagine Shakespeare would have wanted the rest of the play to be finished.
That's great.
And what does that mean for us as people who have literally found ourselves in a story that is incomplete, and we have been asked mm-hmm. to participate in it and to work and to be contributing to the rest of the story, to be the actors in part five? It means that we have to know the story really, really well. And so I really love, Stanford, as you're just like drawing out, what is Genesis even telling us about what we were tasked with in the beginning? What was our original design? And like, there are so many possibilities for what that could look like to bring order out of chaos.
The move that I want to make is expand what people think can be kingdom work, but then also not to say like, well, like everything is considered kingdom work, you know? But I love the idea that it's improvising. Mm-hmm. It's improvising a particular story. It's not just a what makes you feel good, mm-hmm. but it's no, what continues the ethic and what continues the emphases and what continues the drumbeat of this particular kingdom that we're wanting to live into. Before we moved into the church life land, while we were talking, we sort of figured out that like there were some things that we wanted to say to sort of everybody that we kind of thought was good general wisdom for basically everyone. But there's also things that as we've made these transitions and as we've lived life, it's like I have some thoughts that I'm not sure are right and certainly can't be advice for everyone. But sort of think on some level, if people were to take it seriously, it would help them. It would improve their experience. So we're going to call this little segment, Is This Just Me? Is this just me? Is this just my thoughts? And so I will show you what I mean. I'll go first, okay? In this post-college world where you're sort of in the adult world, and I'm particularly thinking of like, you know, Katie and I were seriously dating, and so I'm like meeting her friends, meeting her family members, and I remember just taking it very seriously. Like I wanted to be the kind of person that when she introduced me to people, she didn't have to like worry about me. Like I found it to be like a major success when we were meeting a group of her friends or I was at a family function that she could actually leave me and trust that like I would be okay. And so I feel like the is this just me is like, I feel like one thing that will just make your life better is if you try to be the kind of person that people feel comfortable introducing other people to. Because I will say, I always talk about wedding parties just because I think maybe they're just a cool image of a particular time in your life and just who's special to you. But one thing that's so awesome about wedding parties is that the bringing in of different people from different parts of your life. But one thing that's terrifying is like everyone who I love, are they all going to love each other? You know, they're meeting for like a day or a couple days and I am like the only like common link between them. And so it's very terrifying. Like, what if this group of people thinks that group of people is lame? What if that group of people doesn't like that group of people? But it is so mesmerizingly sublime when these people that you love, love each other and want to love each other and get along and laugh. And so I've always had this attitude of like, every time that I'm like being introduced to someone, I want to give the person introducing me that experience. Which feels like way too high of a call. And like, you're not going to always be everyone's best friend on first meeting. Like, I get that. But if you were to just sort of take it a little bit on yourself to be like, I'm committing to be like a positive social force in this interaction. And this won't be surprising to you. But if that sounds so terrifying to you, just promise me you'll do this thing. Always have a few questions in your back pocket. Because questions are always going to show interest. And it'll be impressive that you are not waiting for the social life to come to you. But in that scenario, you are bringing some social connection. And they'll be like, wow, that's a very confident young man. That's a very confident young woman. Anyway, I feel like if you were to care about being someone that someone feels comfortable to introduce to other people, it will behoove you. And if that terrifies you, then just do this. Put some questions in your back pocket that you'll ask everyone.
Literally. Write them down on a piece of paper. Put them
in your
back pocket.
That's right.
So what do you think?
I actually think that might not just be you. Like that is actually pretty empirical. Yeah. Meg Jay's book actually has a chapter dedicated to what she calls loose bonds. And the idea is that in this life stage, you exhaust the opportunities available in your tight circle pretty quickly. And most vocational opportunities you get come from loose bonds. And so this is actually a time where you want people to introduce you to other people to form these loose bonds that might turn up an opportunity. But you know what makes that easier? Being someone who's easy to introduce to people.
Right.
And I think that as we've stated before, I am an introvert. But I learned pretty quick in my 20s that I needed to learn some introverted coping mechanisms. And one of them is just to have a couple of stock questions that you can ask 40-year-olds, just to get them talking and engage them, because it's an entry into a conversation that kind of signals confidence and gets them thinking, oh, you know what? This person is a psychology major, and I know someone who has a position looking for that. Maybe I'll just introduce them, because it was very comfortable to be introduced to this person.
Right. The reason I think it's just me is because I know that there's this broken mechanism in me where I think very, very quiet people are being selfish. Like they're choosing to be quiet when they could be choosing to participate in the conversation. And then I think sometimes it's like, well, Peter, that's because you're an extrovert. And I'm like, yeah, but for extroverts, it's not always easy to go in, especially to a new crowd of people. Like that's almost always intimidating. But if you sort of just make a commitment and say, I'm going to treat this very scary scenario in a way that like puts me in a position to bring some positive energy. And you know, it's honestly, I remember taking tennis PE and the coach said, every tennis player hates the wind. And so you're going to decide that you love the wind.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
The moment you decide that's that you right. love the wind, you have this psychological advantage over your opponent. And so that's, I think that's what I'm saying. That meeting new people and being introduced to a group of new people is always hard. For right. extroverts and for introverts. It is always hard. And so what I think would behoove you is if you decide right now, I'm going to do
right,
well
right.
at these things. That's and it's going to maybe be all my social energy that I have for a month is going to be put into that time. But I think it's worth it. Yeah.
So mine's related. So I'll jump in and go next. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe this is just me, but I found it really useful in my years after college to figure out why people are interesting who didn't interest me. All right, let me say that again. There was this group of people that didn't interest me, and I needed to figure out why they were interesting. Now, for me, that particular group of people was about half the population. It was it was men. Like, I found this weird thing happen after college where I could have a pretty good conversation with any woman at church. But if I got in a conversation with a man, I ran out of tennis balls, to use Peter's analogy, pretty quickly. I did not find them interesting. And I said, this is not their problem. This is like half the human population. This is clearly my problem. And so what I did is, this was actually like near the beginning of the internet, not to embarrass myself and my age, but I went on to ESPN.com. It was a brand new thing, newfangled thing in the world, for 5 minutes a day and studied sports. Up until that time, I played a lot of sports, but I hadn't really like been a sports fan. Now I was in Madison, Wisconsin, where the Badgers were the thing. And I found that sports are really interesting. And you know who else is interesting? People who are interested in sports. And it just unlocked a whole realm of friendship to me. And these friendships aren't sports based, but the common ground of being a Badger fan created an entry into these relationships that then became about richer things, but you need some common ground. And so I found that instead of being not interested in a certain group of people, just like positing the hypothesis that they are interesting and then testing that hypothesis generally finds that, oh, actually these people are interesting and I'm going to enjoy them.
That's challenging me. I mean, I know almost nothing about sports. This March was like such a relief because I wasn't hearing everyone talk about March Madness. I feel like for the first time I could participate in conversations during March. Mine, I think that I'm realizing that I'm trying to compensate for the fact that everyone in college life seems to be like in STEM and I just don't get it. So I'm trying to like bring them over to like my world a little bit more. I just think that everyone should write about their post-grad experience. And I think everyone should write about everything. Like you should just get in the habit of writing. But especially like after you graduate, it's such a unique time of life and you're going to have a lot of things that you're processing. And I found it really helpful and continue to find it really helpful to like when I'm feeling really angsty or really confused to just like get the words on the paper and not try to solve my problems, but just to know like I had these thoughts and now they exist in the world somewhere beyond my own head. And I can. And then also like there's going to be a point in your life where you're not in this stage of life anymore and you're going to have younger people in your life who are, and to have your own reflections on what that was like to refer to in order to be a better support to those people in your life, I just think would be so invaluable. That's my advice that I'm not quite sure if it's just me or not, but.
Yeah. Okay, so Okay, we come to the last frontier of our conversation.
Frontierland.
Frontierland. We've talked about the social transition. We've talked about the vocational steps that you're going to take. And, you know, we are a Christian organization and we think about things of the church. And so you are approaching a transition where you're going from probably one church community and one Christian community to another one. But also you're coming up to a transition where generally most churches no longer have a focus group for you. You might go to a church that has a young 20s group, but it won't be as robust. There's probably not someone paid to lead that ministry often. And so, you know, if you've been in the church your whole life, you've gone from children's ministry, you've gone to youth ministry, and maybe you've done college ministry, and now it's just ministry. Now it's just the church after this. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about expectations a few times in this conversation. And I sort of save my thoughts for this because I think this is sort of where the rubber meets the road for me, because I am constantly torn between how to talk about this, because I think the expectations matter so much. Like the expectations you go into something with have such a powerful way to shape your experience with it. And I remember Stanford and Amanda, you guys did our premarital counseling. And I remember you talked a lot about some of the challenges that can come in your first year of marriage, and then said, hey, we wanted to maybe come on a little strong because we wanted you to not be surprised if you came up upon these things. But listen, it's not always like that. But it was really, really important for me to have, oh yeah, sometimes the first year of marriage is really hard, because the way it worked for me was that I was delighted that it was way easier than potentially it could have been. And I am aware of the risk on that, both sides of that, because I think that also if you have a warning of expectation, then you could be looking for all the things that are going to match that. And then you could have sort of this like negative mindset going in. And I think I've come to the conclusion that I would rather prepare people for the fact that it can be disappointing and you will be disappointed by something along the way. And it doesn't have to be massive things, but it's impossible for the church to be exactly what you think the church should be doing to answer God's call in the world. That's how I kind of want to start this conversation, is to say out front that yes, the church can be disappointing. I guess basically we want to help you become a thriving member of a local church. And I think one of the things that we need to do that is to let you know that you might be disappointed by that local church, and then to how to push through that disappointment. One thing that I have said to college lifers as they've had disillusionment with college life or been frustrated with me, I've told them, hey, this is a really important moment for you, because right now you can choose to see all the things that you're disappointed by and then choose to build something that you think would be better. Like choose to sort of partner with the ministry and build something better, or you could bail, or you could like give in to your bitterness, which would either mean you leaving or just feeding your own bitter soul. And so what I tell them is that building is better than bitterness. And this is a really powerful moment for you, because it could be that when you're disappointed with the church in your future, you will have memory where you chose to build as opposed to just be bitter. And that's going to serve you really well, because that's what the church needs. The church needs people who see the disappointments of the church and choose not to bail and choose not to just feed their bitterness, but choose to build something with the church that's better.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that's some of the most important advice you could receive transitioning into this life stage, is that the church for the first time is not going to be customized to you. It's actually going to be mostly customized to these building generations, people in their 40s and their 50s. And you're going to be faced with choices. Regardless of the church that you find, it's probably not going to be culturally identical to your desires. And you're going to have some grown-up choices to make. And you know, one of the main things that I like to tell people is, at some point in my life, I discovered that there is nowhere in the Bible a spiritual gift of criticism, because criticism leads to bitterness. And I think that everyone goes through a process where their eyes start to open to the fact that there are things in the church they just wish were different. And some of those things are actual brokenness of our particular culture. And some of those things are just things they don't understand yet. But I went through a period of like this in my early 20s, where I had just a lot of criticism for the church, a lot of bitterness in my heart. And I had a mentor in grad school at one point, and he's just a person of a lot of joy. And I just assumed he was naive. Like, I just assumed that he didn't see the things I saw, that I was more insightful. And then I heard him talking at one point with another friend, and I realized, oh no, he like has more insight than I do. He understands exactly what's wrong with our church and understands more things than I do. But somehow there's a place of maturity beyond bitterness. And I just thought that insight and this growing dissatisfaction was the process of maturity, but that actually there's a whole nother level you get to level up beyond bitterness and be able to understand and want to build something in the church that's true and right and just. But you can do that from a place of joy and love. And that was one of the like transitional moments in my life where I realized, oh, I'm not on the mm-hmm. path of maturity here, of my growing insight into satisfaction. I actually need to move past that into a phase of love and joy.
I feel challenged by that. I remember someone telling me a few years ago that they had noticed a trend in seeing people's attitude that they would ask like, oh, what did you get out of that service? What did you get out of the sermon? And the question's not fundamentally flawed, but it does hint at like this attitude that like church is just there to serve us, as opposed to like, what can we do to be serving and building up the church? That hasn't totally changed the way that I engage with the church, but I do notice that as sort of like a litmus test for like, where is my criticism coming from? Where is my frustration coming from? Because most of the time it's coming from this kind of privileged belief that like I just deserve to have the church serve all of my needs and meet all my needs, as opposed to, I am a contributing member of this family and it's going to be messy and it's not all about me.
I think the reason why I care about setting the expectations is because there's this nexus that's fraught with potential to be critical. And I think the nexus is the fact that it's very, very important. God's presence on earth now is through his people. The church is, it couldn't be more important. And yet the church is and has been so flawed, both on the macro level and in the micro level. Like there are things that, you know, churches are led by people and they put the wrong emphases on things. And they put, like I said, their tone is not always right. And they don't always say the right words. They don't always respond at the right time, or they don't always make the right decision. And so I think the fact that it's so important and can be messed up, the church is in a strange position because it feels like to be critical is actually to be faithful. Because if the church is doing something wrong, even if it's sort of innocuous, it seems like, well, no, we should be being more faithful. And I have the right ideas, so to speak. And so I think that's what makes it really hard. And I think I look at people, the person that comes to mind is Keith Reddenbaugh, who's an elder at FBC. And honestly, I don't know him that well, but I see in him just utter commitment to FBC. You know, you sort of think, well, he's been here for a long time. He's probably been disappointed at times. He's probably thought we're not always doing the right thing. And so is that weakness in him? You know, is that an unfaithfulness, the fact that he hasn't incited all the change he would have wanted to have seen? Or is that this slow, methodical faithfulness, commitment to a local body? He leads the Maranatha group, the elderly people at the church. And he just does that quietly all the time. You know, it's like I have no idea if he's been bitter in the past. No idea. But like, if he has, he's chosen to harness that and say, well, I might wish that we were doing something different, but instead of being bitter about it, I'm going to choose to build something and serve this particular community. And that is who I want to be when I am there. And I don't want to be filled with bitterness toward the church because it's not doing what I think its job should be. And that's what I would really love for our students to be when they get there too.
That's just a mature commitment to a diverse community. Churches are fundamentally diverse, and it can't be everything that you hope it to be in order to be everything that God wants it to be. The alternative is to kind of move from this consumer mentality to a production. If you invest in a community, that generates affection. And so the thing to do is to find something to do and contribute, and that'll start to build joy. Here's the problem. The stuff that they will give you to do is not particularly interesting. Most institutional churches will not respect your ministry experience from college. We could talk about whether that's right or wrong, but it's just kind of a fact. And so a lot of student leaders have had a lot of really great ministry experience and would love to join a church and just jump right in. And you're going to have to start at the bottom. You're going to have to earn the trust of your church. We were part of a campus ministry, Amanda and I, that we love. It had a little bit of a different structure. So there was like actually a student president, which was goofy, but that was me. And so I was helping to lead this college ministry about the size of College Life. But there was a Miriam and a Peter. There were two adults that were helping me out and really doing the leading. And so it didn't really fall on me. And then the summer before my junior year, one of them got pulled off campus and the other had a no kidding brain aneurysm that took him 18 months to recover from. And so I walked into my junior year suddenly in charge of this campus ministry, basically the size of a small church. And it went just really poorly. I like to call those years tragic and beautiful. I made a ton of mistakes, but it was a lot of ministry experience, right? I was making a lot of mistakes and learning from them. And Amanda just had an unbelievable college career in ministry. She led small groups all the way through, but mainly she had this particular ministry where she would lead small groups, particularly for people who were curious about the faith, but had no church background. And over the course of her college years, she got to walk through the process of deciding to follow Jesus with a number of individuals. And so we come out of college and we're hyped. We're ready to go. We want the church to put us to work. And so we get there and we actually don't wait. We make a meeting with one of the pastors. So we're in this room with this old guy. And it's funny to call him old because he's probably quite a bit younger than I am now, but in my mind, he's old. And we tell him, hey, we're ready to go. What do you need? And he's like, oh, you guys, bless you. You're such a blessing, which is how old people in the Midwest talk. And he said, we actually have a desperate need. And we were like, that's the one. Give us that one. We want your desperate need. And he said, we cannot seem to find anyone to show up at 7:30 to run the 3-year-old nursery.
Wow. It's like, sir, do you need to see my credentials again?
Yeah, right. Can I give you a ministry resume? We had a choice at that point. You know, we could kind of take our ball and go home and say that's beneath us, or we could do what the church needed done. And so for a couple of years, we ran the 3-year-old nursery until they said, those people, they're faithful. Let's give them something else to do. And, you know, 10 years later, Dan Seitz took a chance on us in college ministry and kind of who we are and where we are now. But we had to go through that process of earning trust. Yeah. And that's not wrong. You know, it's on church leadership to trust you before they give you more important work.
Yeah, I said that your talk on this subject just had these like sound bites in my mind that never left. And one of them, you sort of surveyed people, maybe asking the question, like, what advice would you give graduating seniors? And someone said, learn the soundboard at the church. To this idea, it's like, that's a job that not a lot of people want to do. Not a lot of people know how to do. And if you do it, you're actually like really important to the church. You got behind the scenes look at stuff. They're there for Sunday mornings. You have a really important Sunday morning role. And
Chris Dunn is one of the only people who is mission essential at FBC right now. And most people don't know who he is.
Yeah, it's true. He runs the soundboard. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think it's a little bit tricky because if we're saying, hey, the way to not be bitter is to build. But if we're also saying at the same time, you get to build with some baby blocks at the beginning, those are really important things to know, especially if you're, you know, growth group leader in college life. You're really shepherding people.
That's right. You're doing real ministry.
Yeah, you're doing real life ministry, and you might not have. Hopefully there is a youth ministry or a children's ministry or a college ministry that needs a Bible study leader or someone to teach a little bit. And hopefully you can fill that need. But maybe not. You know, like I just said, I was talking with Justin Morton, and he was saying that one thing he's going to miss the most about FBC is that this was the first church that was excited to use him. And he is a PhD in philosophy. You know, if he's going to churches and they're not putting him to work, then it stands to reason that sometimes the church staff, which I am one of, like we miss seeing the talent, so to speak, or the eagerness that people have to serve. We miss it, you know, and so it's not always going to be a clean transition from really important ministry work in college to really important feeling ministry work after college.
And then one other thing is just don't wait to be noticed. Offer yourself, you know, make yourself available and then say yes to what they ask you to do. And church staffs are rightly not impressed by gifting or skill. Church staffs are impressed by faithfulness, and that takes a while to demonstrate, and it will get you asked to do other things.
I just think that this particular conversation matters so much to me because I went through a period of just being disillusioned by the church, and I think on the other side of that, there's freedom to just love it. And it's become so normal to me that as I'm saying it all out loud now, I can hear a skeptic saying, like, if this thing is so disappointing, why don't you just bail on it? Just like pose that as a potential to yourself. And I was like, I wouldn't want to. Like, I'm convinced that this is God's mission for the world, is to use his people to bring his kingdom. And even though this particular vessel has leaks, like, this is the chosen vessel. And we get to serve it and love it and hopefully be blessed by it, but also to lend it our hand. So, Miriam, do you have anything to add?
I don't know. Just that image of like someone passing through bitterness and reaching a point of maturity and saying, that's not where the story should end. It should end with just continuing to serve and give and to love, to really love the church.
Yeah, the last thing I'll say, and this is purely anecdotal, but I'm thinking about like my cohort of college life people who graduated near me and around me. Obviously, you know, some people graduate and they have since walked away from the faith, and others are very committed. And I will say that at least for a while, what I noticed was those who left the faith tended not to find themselves inculcated in a small group of committed believers. And those who seem to be strong in the faith seem to be people who had sort of committed to the small group of believers. And so I think what I want to say as maybe a last pastoral word on this is that it's not just about attending a particular church, but like, is there a church where you can belong with a smaller group of people where you can actually live this life with, and you can ask questions and you can study the scriptures and you can pray together and you can be involved in each other's lives and you can know each other's homes? And I think that in doing that, not that you insulate yourself from sort of the risk, quote unquote, of walking away from the faith, but when you're surrounded by a group like that, you're living sort of life on mission together. So the story remains plausible. The beauty of the story is still striking to you. And so I guess the last thing I would say to our graduating people is what I hope for you is that you'd be a member of a church and a committed one, but also the next level down, what I'm hoping for you is that you would commit yourself to a small group of people to live this life with in this next stage. And I think if you do, your faith will continue to thrive and will continue to be the thing guiding your life. And so that's what I got. Well, we are going to transition to our last quarantine corner, and this has been a long conversation from our end. And so Stanford had to go back to his day job, and so he is not joining us for this quarantine corner. So it'll feel different without him, but also feel different because we're doing something a little bit different. You know, last week, Miriam, your quarantine corner was to spend time in reflection, which I really love. And it actually became the weekly Father Time challenge for, and so it's been on my mind a lot. And so for quarantine corner, instead of giving people a recommendation of what to do, we're just going to like dive more deeply into your quarantine corner from last week. And I thought it'd be fun for you and I to just give like a favorite memory from the year. I can go first if you want. Do you want me to go first? You want to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
So I wanted it to be like a moment. Right. And I remember, I think I'm like diabolically attached to small moments. You know this in working with me. I love the beauty of small things that just show you something in a way that you very easily look over it, but is really profound. And there was a moment at one of the afterlife parties. Shouts to my guy, William, who created that name. But what we would do after college life, we would go to Yuleberry to sort of extend the social time. And by the way, any Davis institutions that are looking for a way to make sure to have a business model that lasts, here's what we need. We need a place that is open late, that is like right next to campus, that has both desserts and like yummy food. So it's like if someone is like, oh, I never had dinner, I can just order like a burger or something like that, or a sandwich or some fries. Or it's like, oh, if I've already had dinner, here's some ice cream or like a pie. This place would
never
eat it
go
up
out of business.
With college ministries. Yeah. This is what we need. But anyways, there was this one time where I have this like theory in social situations that I just like to sit more than I like to stand. So I grabbed one of the chairs at Yuleberry and I just sat down, and there was a group of people chatting around me. And slowly there was like, our conversation became sort of like everyone's conversation. Like slowly there was a circle that was building. Mm-hmm. And Ian Biscardi, him and I were talking about video games.
Yeah.
And I am no lover of video games. But I remember someone in high school asking me what my passion was. And I'm like, dude, I don't know. I think it might be other people's passions. That might be what my passion is. And so I was asking about video games, and it just became this like huge conversation of asking everyone what their favorite video game was. And everyone just had some experience or some level of, you know, even if it was like the phone games on the iPhone. And I was sitting there thinking like, I love this. I love this moment. Like, first of all, like Ian was new to the community and maybe hadn't had a chance to meet all these people. And now they're all talking about the thing that he's interested in. And I was like, oh, this is like beauty to me. And then you get to see these people's like hidden assumptions about all sorts of different stuff that maybe they didn't thought about in years. And it's just hilarious conversation. And I think moments like that are really special to me because I think in my position, I'm always aware of the end time. Like I'm always aware if I'm in a meeting, it's only an hour and a half. There's very few times when time feels like endless and not pressing down on me. And so that time where it's like, okay, college life is over, everything's packed up, we can actually just be together.
Yeah.
And it was one of those moments where like, this is why I love this job. It just felt really good to be alive. And again, it's like those small moments that I'm just so attracted to. This was just us being together and knowing each other. And I loved it.
I love it. Yeah, I remember that conversation. That was a really, really good one. And what was so cool is that it was a really good one, and it wasn't anything that I was like, whoa, this is crazy that this is like so fun and so wild. It was just like, this is just another day in the life of this community. And I have a lot of memories because this is like my first year. And so everything sort of hit me in a way that it probably wouldn't have hit many other people. But one memory that feels particularly special was back in January. We had just like a really busy day. And I don't remember when it started. I think it was like we had a meeting at Pete's at like 6 a.m.
You and me?
And then, and I did. And then my day, and probably yours too, was pretty much full of like other meetings and work stuff and like other life stuff too, that just didn't stop until we finished our last meeting, which was a discipleship information meeting at Allie and Maddie and Audrey, Megan's place. The meeting wrapped up probably at like 11 or something.
It was an intense day.
It was an intense day. But I was in a rush to get there. I had just grabbed some dinner from Nugget and was on my way over. And I felt so like alive, and I was so excited for this meeting. And I just like remember thinking, I really believe in this. Like, I really believe in the discipleship program, and I'm so excited to talk with people about it. But I don't know who's going to show up. Like, maybe this will be sort of a disappointment. And we get there and people start showing up, and it's like all sorts of people from our community who are just coming and interested. And it felt like instantly just felt like family and just being in a living room together. I don't know, just something about it felt really special. And then getting to pitch this idea of discipleship felt like, this is the most important thing I could be doing right now. Like, there's nothing else I would want to be doing, and there's nothing else that I feel like I need to be doing. And so it was like this mix of like, this is so important, and also we're just having fun together. Before we started, like, we're sitting on the couch with like Omar and Brayden, and we were eating Cheez-Its. And
massive Cheez-Its. They were massive
Cheez-Its. Yeah, the massive Cheez-Its. Yeah. And somebody had said that they had heard you could break them in half. You could split them at like the seam. And we spent way too long and ate way too many Cheez-Its to, like, trying to accomplish this mission. It was so fun. And I remember leaving that meeting, and I was going on a trip the next day, and I should have been so exhausted, but I was just felt like energized and like I could go do it. I could go do this whole day again. And just feeling very, very full.
I remember a similar thing happening during Welcome Week. I think it was after we had a cereal under the stars. And you know, that event is like so immense with heavy labor. Like, we're creating a living room, for those who don't know, on top of the parking structure. So we're lifting couches and ottomans and chairs and carpets and everything, and to enjoy them for a couple hours and then just bring them all back. And that was after a long day of a lot of social energy and a lot of on our feet and a lot of walking in the hot sun. And so we probably get done at 11 midnight, something like that. And I remember there was like a group of us just sort of sitting in my old office and just laughing and so delirious. And this is a sweet reward. This moment right here of, you've just put in so much effort, you are ridiculously tired, and yet you're doing it together.
And with that event too, I was going to actually share that one too, because I remember talking with you beforehand as you were explaining what it was going to look like and we were planning it. You had said, okay, maybe we need like this many couches or something. And I was like, Peter, there is just no way we're going to get 7 couches on the top of that parking structure. And I was like a complete doubter. I did not trust that this was going to work. And then sure enough, everyone's like bringing all the furniture up to the top of it. And I remember thinking, this is something very, very special. Like, this community is not something you come by often, where like people can put their heads together and make this work, because this is an immense task that just sort of, it felt like it just happened.
It
and
did.
I know that isn't the case, but like, it took a lot of hard work, but it was way easier because everyone believed in it and everyone was like, we can do this. And
It's the best. We are wrapping up our, I guess we can call it, the first little season of the podcast. And it has been really one of the greatest thrills of my career the last few years, and getting to do something that was this creative. So thank you all for listening and for talking to me about it, and for laughing at our quarantine corners, and for thinking that our content was useful enough to share or to affirm. Thank you for that. And you know, a lot of people have asked what's going to happen with the podcast. All we can say is that it's been really fun. It's been a ton of work. And so we're going to take just a little bit of a break and regroup to think, what does this look like going forward? Because we would love to keep doing them. And your enthusiasm for it has made it more intriguing to keep going with it. What a year it has been, Miriam.
What a year.
It's always sad to wrap it up. And it's been a joy, and it's been a thrill. And Miriam, it was so fun to do it with you and with Stanford. Same. He can't speak for himself right now.
I'm sure he would. It has been an absolute privilege and a blast.
All right, that is it for season one of Your Pod and Your Staff. Before we end, I want to make something clear. We say in the podcast that building is better than bitterness when it comes to the church, and we believe that. But I wouldn't want to drown out the emphasis that you do have opportunity to improve the church and call it to be what it is supposed to be.
and we would be so proud of you if you did. What we were trying to communicate is that we hope that that would be done via commitment and love for the church, not bitterness and criticism. And I hope that's clear. But as we end, let me say this, that this podcast has been the journey I didn't know I wanted. I've said it over and over, but thank you so much to all the people who have made this possible. Thank you to Heidi Rudvogts for getting me started, telling me what to do, what not to do. Thank you, as always, to Josh Paskey and Kyle Jung for making the music. It gives me goosebumps every time I hear it. And thank you to Bronwyn Lee and Justin Morton and Jess and Kyle and Paul and Maddie for all lending your wisdom and your expertise. And thank you to Katie, my wife, for sitting next to me and still loving me as I sat there for hours and hours and hours like a robot editing. And thank you to my mom and my dad and my grandma and my mother-in-law and Neil Redenbaugh and Dan Seitz and everyone who affirmed us and encouraged us. It kept us going. And to Stanford and Miriam, what can I say? If we were in a movie, I think we'd deserve a cool scene where we all look at each other, give each other a knowing nod, and walk into the distance. In other words, there's little I can do to express my gratitude for you giving your thoughts, your time, your heart, your energy, your care, and your patience to me as we learned how to do this. We made something really special. And by the time you all hear this, these will be the last words of the college life year. This is a big deal. Another incredible year is in the books, one that I will remember forever. And despite everything, one that I will remember fondly. Here's to the people we met, the people who grew, and of course, to those we say goodbye. And so, our dearest college life, we love you more than, well, I think you get it by now. We love you a lot, more than you know. We'll see you sometime soon.